Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber.
This episode of Red Inca, we talk about the history of Test cricket. To do that, we get on someone who has written a very big book on it.
Hi, I'm Tim Wigmore, author of Test Cricket, A History. Straight in there.
We talk about the non-white West Indian batters, the weird early selection of cricketers, England amateur captains, England's Oxbridge captains, and how few teams ever picked their best players.
I would have put it a little bit lower in front of, but you know, it's not like you've written about 93 books and you should know how to do this by now. So I wrote a history on Test cricket and you read that and thought that book is so shit that I am going to write another one, inferior one. I think we all agree on that. So, I mean, we could, you and I, just bounce forever talking about Test cricket, but you did cover some things that I didn't have a lot on and I did want to talk to you about that. One of the things you covered quite a lot of detail was the white players from the West Indies what sort of piqued your interest about that?
Yeah, well, obviously the Frank Worrall story, the first black captain of tenure, 1960, that's kind of well known. Obviously, I do talk about it a lot in the book, but I was actually thinking about what did it mean to have to have a white captain before, like what does that actually look like? Mm-hmm. And of course what it looks like is you're a bit like the amateur situation, of course, in England, but it means you're picking players and then kind of reverse engineering the rest of the team around them. You're also picking players who aren't as good. So West Indies was white, there were some very good white players who played for West Indies, but the dynamics were basically that the board wanted generally to have about probably four or five white players in their team, if at all possible. For the bulk of the time until 1960, and there was basically no good white bowlers, really. There was Dennis Atkinson, but there was, you know, pretty much no good white bowlers. And therefore, you have a situation where you probably, you know, three or four of your top six will be white batters, including your captain. And this massively weakened the team. So the sort of killer stat, which is really, really damning, is that until 1960, the West Indies white players who bat in their top six, so the guys in specialist batting roles, have an average of 28, and everyone else who bats in the top six has an average of 42 in that time. So you're basically losing 15 runs in innings through doing this policy. And actually, there was a lot of white players who were fully aware that, and actually kind of uncomfortable in some cases, with their position. You know, they knew that they were elevated often to, you know, captaincy incredibly early in their career, or, you know, they just didn't really deserve it just because of the color of their skin. So it very interesting dynamic. And actually,
well, the batting average as well, like, it makes sense. It's kind of like if you had a cricket team where you picked four left-handers and two right-handers, right, and based on the fact that you needed four left-handers in the side and two right-handers. If you just pick the best two right-handers, you are probably going to be in a situation where their averages should be really high because you're not picking. No, do you know what I mean? You're literally picking the two best guys. And then on the other side,
like half the time, you're doing the opposite. Right?
Yeah, it's like George Heather. But even who was the guy he opened with? Like, there were some other decent players in that era, like, it, you know, around him as well. So it wasn't even like, was it Clayton Lambert? Was one of the other openers? Who's the guy that made the double 100? Early on for Roach, is it something Roach? I can't remember all their names, but they had, like, that. My point being is these are probably not ordinary level players. These are, you know, really, really highly skilled players playing in that. And as you said, the opposite is also true. And this also, you mentioned before the amateur system of England. It's very similar, right? It's like there are amateur bowlers when you go through the history of English cricket. But the vast majority,
you know, he's got his own gate at Lords, but he's like the one, and he's like kind of like the only one, really. And you have a situation in England where very similar. You're picking a guy who has to be, you know, from the right sort of family, to coin a phrase, and therefore you're kind of, yeah, you're damaging the whole balance of your team, and you're picking a very weak player. And often, of course, you're also kind of hiding the player because generally these guys would not open their bat at like five or six, which is the easiest bat, as you know, from your book. And instead, they're averaging not very much. So in the first 10 Ashes tours that MCC run from 1903 to 1951, so that's 50 test matches, and England captains in that have an overall average of 22 with the bat. Top score was 79. And you're like, okay, well, maybe they're bowlers. And actually, they only get 70 wickets in those 50 matches. So just over a wicket a game, which is basically when Gubby Allen is captain, he is that number. But yeah, so you're there's all these big theories, you know, John Arlott's theory of kind of Australianism, that Australians win because they want it a bit more and so on. But actually, Australia are just better at picking their best actual 11 players.
They're playing an extra player in every game than England is, right? They're literally picking at all 11 players. And to go back to the thing you were just talking about there, and it works for both because, as you said, quite often, whether it be the white captains of the West Indies or the captains from the right kind of families in England, it's further down the order in the middle of in that position. And they don't bowl largely because people who are upper class, people who have privilege, don't bowl as much. Like, if you look at the history of cricket, why would you want to do that? Like, if you at home, if you've got a plantation and you've got, you know, black people working on it for you, right? You're not probably in your prime physical condition, right? Like, you know, you're not a coal miner, right? Like, you know, all the different things that we talk about within sort of old timey cricket. And so you're putting yourself in a position where there aren't any bowlers. And so you're almost doing what American sports does, right? With the NFL, where it's like every position is racially coded.
Yeah. And which actually shows, I guess, one of the causes, it does show like George Headley in a whole, you know, different light even more to be, he would have to have been that much better just to get into the team as a black batter and then to be as good as he is, you know, with at every turn really the opportunity and just the assumptions that, you know, you will be a bowler because of the colour of your skin. And so that does put George Headley into his sort of political standing, you know, shows him up even more. But you have, I mean, one of the examples with Jerry Alexander. So he's appointed captain 1958, and at the time of his appointment, he's played two tests, and his scores are not out, didn't get out, fair enough, 11, 0 and 0. And they're like, yeah, you're captaining us. Don't worry about Frank Worrell. Yeah, you're now our captain. And he's
nowhere near one of the worst white players. Like, Jerry Alexander,
he does well in the 60-61 tour. He's actually quite a good cricketer, but as he said, you know, he had no right to be appointed. You have Jack Grant, he plays only 12 test matches in the 30s, and he's captain every single time, has an average of 25 with the bat. So that's a kind of typical example. And he's also kind of aware. He says, it could not be disputed that my white colour was a major factor in me being given this post. So, yeah, there is. Yeah.
Well, I think if I remember your book right, you said that he didn't even play many first-class games, right? And again, this goes back to the English thing, which is this was very common in England as well, where you have, you know, is it Charles Aubrey Smith captains in South Africa? There's lots of English players who captain in South Africa and versus New Zealand who didn't play a lot of first-class cricket and everything else. But the difference here is that it's like it's classism and racism at the same time. Like, you're kind of getting the double whammy.
Yeah, and also we're at a point when some the good West Indies players would be playing actually in league cricket in England. So they'd actually be developing their skills off season. And the white players are just not going to be doing that because A, they're probably not good enough. No one wants them. And in many cases, and B, because of their social standing, that it's just not something that they would want to do anyway. So these old dynamics are kind of absolutely bizarre.
I didn't even thought about that. That's a really good point because by that stage, by the 1920s, there's quite a few West Indians playing league cricket, aren't they? And that's what Leary wants to do, and all that sort of stuff. And so you're right. It's West Indies have accidentally, as much as anything, basically produced a professional subsection of their cricketers who they're not picking themselves, right? Like, or they're picking the best of. There was one series that you had the numbers here. 1950 tour, they had a squad of 9 white players, 6 black players, and 1 of Indian descent. Like, the numbers are not numbering well there, are they? If we considering everything we've just said about their batting averages, it's like that feels like, and they don't bowl. There's a lot of white guys who don't bat very well and won't
very
bowl.
Happy to, lots of specious number sevens, really, which is not how you build a good team. Which is And then you have this, and you have to have the captain being white. So I haven't got to this point yet, but it would be really interesting. You could do as a project, it would be very interesting to do a kind of wins above replacement. And you could probably work out that, you know, the preference for white players cost West Indies, say, 4 or 5 test matches till 1960. That would be, you know, it would be that sort of number, which is quite a lot because they don't win that many, you know, until the 50s, they don't win a lot of test matches at all. And they're weakening themselves effectively on purpose because they'd rather have more white players and have a better team ultimately.
And it's worth, you know, I know, you know, some people will know about this, but it's also worth pointing out that this is not like a, they're not a normal cricket country because they're not a cricket country, right? So their selection is really random. It's not, that's not the only issue they have with selection. So for instance, Frank Borrell is the first permanent black captain, but George Headley does captain for one test match. And one of the reasons he only captained for one test match is they were rotating it, and each island or each ground or committee, whatever, however you want to put it, exactly, got to pick their own captain. So you've already got like all these different countries, all these different conflicting issues going on. You've got this terrible selection committee at home that's doing all sorts of rancid things. Like quite often the West Indies would pick a local player just so they would have a local player in that game, even if they weren't
all the time. So in their first ever home test series, 1930 versus England, they picked 28 players across the four matches. It's like England in the 90s, and they have four different captains. So one from each island, of course, all of them are white. So you have a, you know, you have captain who's shipped in for a single game. So actually, it's kind of incredible that West Indies are as good as they are until 1960, because they're probably on average picking sort of what equivalent to a sort of a second 11. You know, probably has half of their actual best five or six players, and then five or six who are just there because either the island they're from or the color of their skin or both. So it's an incredibly bizarre way to pick a team. And actually, just to take the story forward, you know, one of the reasons West Indies get so much better, and we have the sort of the super team that emerges from the 70s, is they actually start to pick from the whole region. So 1973 is when they first pick a player from outside the big four. So the big four, Ghana, Trinidad, Jamaica, Barbados, who you know, dominate and still kind of, in a way, still do dominate Caribbean cricket. But you know, they had all the selectors, and they would only pick their own. So when I talked with Andy Roberts, who was the first Antiguan to play test cricket, obviously a great, great test cricketer, but he basically said there was a lot of blokes from Antigua who were better than me, who never got a chance in test cricket. So again, if they'd been picking more on merit earlier, and actually one of the themes of the kind of unintentional kind of themes of the book, things that amazed me was how rare it is in test cricket history that you have a team that literally is the best possible 11 players, and you're like just picking the best 11 players without worrying about everything else. And again, I think Australia with, you know, some big exceptions, Eddie Gilbert and so on, are basically closer to picking their best 11 on average, I think, than, and you're Victorian, so you'll be bitter about Brad Hodge and a few.
No, but when does Western Australia start playing Shield cricket? Western Australia start playing in the 60s, yeah, mid-60s? Tasmania start playing in the 80s and 90s? Early 80s? Like, I mean, you could still argue now that Northern Territory, which has produced test cricketers, probably could produce more if they had, you know, more access. Regional Queensland is probably another place that I think traditionally has had cricketers, but if they don't make it down to Brisbane, they're not playing. You know, there was always the whole thing about Canberra, that if you're a local kid in Canberra, that you really had to go to one of the other cities. And, you know, Nathan Lyons probably made that look more realistic than everyone else. But even within Tasmania, right, like you had the Launceston crew and you had the Hobart crew, right? And that's like a 4-hour drive between the two. So it's really random. No, I think Australia probably did it better than most places. You're right. But it's like,
anyway.
No.
But Australia at least.
And I think, and there's no way, how would selectors have even seen any of these players, right? Like that's the other thing.
The way a team is actually picked is basically horse trading. It's like, Jared, you want these two players. I want these two players. Yeah. There's only like two slots. Well, you have one pick, I have one pick, and maybe the best two players were both your guys, but I haven't seen your second guy. And also, I'm from Barbados and I want to get my guy in the team because part of what I'm judged, you know, part of what I'm judged on is having enough of my guys in the team. Also, I do not want a home test match without enough of my guys. You know, that's embarrassing for me. And so, yeah, you end up in, yeah, just the way teams are picked is completely flawed in so many different ways. And you have to be, yeah, so George Headley, of course. And there's a sliding doors moment where he could have gone to become a dentist and he's lost to test cricket. And then who knows? And that, I says that, yeah, the average, yeah, he would have lowered that average for sure had he not been around.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing of, I don't think people realize that, like, New Zealand's a perfect example of this, and I don't know if you go into it in the book, but I think you could come up with a pretty good New Zealand 11 for 1936, 1937, right, of players who were, like, there was a couple of players playing in New Zealand who were good, but most of their best players were playing either, yeah, in England, and obviously then you also had Clary Grimmett in Australia. So if you brought back the players who were playing counter cricket, the players who were playing for Julian Khan's 11, if you brought back Clary Grimmett, they're probably not that far away from India's level at that point, right?
Stewie Dempster plays 10 tests, average of 65 in the 30s. Yep. Then he goes to play for Julian Carnes 11 and, you know, earning more money. He plays for Leicestershire and he's just, he wants to be a professional cricketer, basically. And he can't do that in New Zealand. So New Zealand, yeah, they again and again, they're losing players all the time. In fact, it's almost like they go to England. It's almost like it's almost like a trial for some guys to then go and become pros and get at least a league deal, if not with a county, and actually kind of get into the system. So, yeah.
And if you really think about that, that doesn't stop until Colpack stops.
No, you have with Glenn Turner, for, you know, a great example of that in the 70s and early 80s, a huge, huge, huge loss because, Test cricket has been terrible at basically at paying players properly and boards have been, New Zealand was run for a long time in quite a kind of amateur way in the kind of worst sense, very much so. Yeah. That's a big
deal. Yeah, I mean, New Zealand's probably, weirdly enough, New Zealand's probably one of the most pure cricket nations because of that, if that makes sense. And I don't mean it in a good way. I almost mean it in the worst possible way. But they just stayed so amateur, even in the face of obvious professionalism around them. They were like, you know, Glenn Turner's coming back going, guys, I think if we trained and you paid us a little bit of money, we could get better. And they're like, whoa, settle down, big dog. That's not what cricket's like here. And that's as they're getting good, right? Like that's the period at which they're getting good. And they were lucky enough to have enough talented players that didn't go off and do what Glenn Turner did. Because if Hadley, Crowe and Wright go off and do what Glenn Turner does, we never get a New Zealand boom, right? Like that could have easily happened.
Yeah, and actually
happened.
To go to the 30s and 40s, actually West Indies are much more, they are pragmatic at actually dealing it. They'll pick Constantine for only a test or two in England when he's missing games because he's not being released. Whereas New Zealand have this sort of such a pure approach in terms of we're not going to. Yeah. But the Constantine reminds me of one of the great stories of shithousery. I think it was a 33 tour West Indies in England. And Constantine's playing for Nelson and he's obviously unbelievable for them. And Nelson basically say, we'll release Constantine to play in the last test. He's played one in the series and done well, and he's missed one. If we get this other player, I think Stan Nichols, I think, as a kind of replacement professional, and then Douglas Jardine hears about this and he picks the replacement guy for England to stop Constantine playing against him, which is really terrible, appalling behaviour, and very much in keeping with kind of England's later treatment of, you know, associate nations and so on.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. Yeah. No. It really, I don't think people really understand that full history of how hard it was for a lot of those nations just to overcome the fact that everything pulled into England, right? Like the way that everyone complains about India now, and it's like, yeah, we had that for 120 years. It's just that there wasn't a strong enough cricket media and everyone just saw England as the mother country and so it allowed it. But then within England, I mean, you talked about this briefly before, that what'd you say, from 1887 to 1952, every England captain was an amateur and they made fuck all runs, right? Like I'm paraphrasing. I don't know if you use the phrase fuck all runs.
Paraphrasing.
What's quite interesting is the double standard with all that as well. So we've already talked about that within the West Indies of, you know, players who know they shouldn't be captain, leading players who are a lot better. But within England, you have this system where they're called amateurs, right? But they are actually given extra stipends and everything else. So it's not even a complete lie. It's just to uphold the sort of the gentleman angle of it. So you're paying someone more to play in a game when you know they're not as good as someone else who you could be paying less. Like it's a bizarre crazy concept. Like I understand classism in England, but fuck me, Wigmore, that's out there.
Jim Lakin once gets in real trouble with the old Test and Counts Cricket Board MCC because he says, you picked me for an Ashes tour. And he's like, I want to be paid, you know, I'm a good cricketer, I deserve to be paid the most I possibly can. He requests to be an amateur for the tour and they say, no, you're not the right kind of person to be an amateur. You can only go as a professional. So it is
I think it would have been great if they said, look, you might be too good as a cricketer to be an amateur at this level. It may be in the 1800s you were good enough to be an amateur, but now we don't have any amateurs like
and,
this anymore.
But it's amazing how, you know, the debates about T20 now, they were all foreshadowed then. Because with Leary Constantine, who obviously would have been an incredible T20 player, you know, he writes in his book in 1946, autobiography, he says, you know, we need a rule that test selection should override every other tie, and that we need to do that by paying players properly and you know, stipulating that you will earn more when you play in a test match, or at least the same as if you're playing a league game. So he has these ideas, and he's also very on the other thing. He says West Indies will only get better when they, well, he says, when we stop having white captains, all like just because they're white, and also when we start picking from all of the Caribbean, not just the big four. So they'd read his book in the 40s.
I don't know if you came across, I don't know if you came across this, and I only came across it really recently, and it was really randomly, which is essentially the Packer family and Don Bradman's relationship goes back way longer than anyone sort of knows. And I think it might have been in a Breddig piece, and I was doing some other research, and I sort of put.
Yeah.
And I sort of two and two came together. And it's like Bradman almost didn't play for Australia because of a sponsorship deal, right? Like,
just four bow lines.
How different would we look at cricket right now if in the middle of his career, Bradman disappeared? And if you think about it from, if Bradman was the greatest Australian male athlete of that era, the next greatest athlete was a guy called Rod Laver, right? Who won two Grand Slams 10 years apart. Why didn't he win more Grand Slams? More because he went off to play professional tennis, and his record is almost irrelevant in that period. And so Bradman could have done a similar thing. And so it was really the, you know, the, it was not, I wouldn't say through dumb luck, but because again, they bent over backwards, and Bradman did end up making a lot of money out of it, right? And did make, you know, it was set up with the stockbrokers and all these different things that maybe he shouldn't have got. Why not just pay the guys? Like, you're actually finding ways to pay them without paying them. It's such a bizarre system that it was just like, but in their heads, they were like, it's a bit like now when you say to people, oh, if we're going to have injury substitutions, we have to have substitutions. And they're like, whoa, no, we can't do that. And it's like, we only don't have substitutions by accident, right? Like every other sport kind of did it and we just forgot. And now we're in this thing where we're like, it's actually part of the game to not have substitutions. And it's like, yeah, but then don't moan when one team is a bowler short and they've only got a three-man attack. So it really is weird that there was never that conversation within cricket to be like, actually, this
course,
makes
sense. Of course, but if Bradman had gone, that probably would have been the moment, because cricket is run by Australia and England at this time until 1993. Yeah. Actually, they have this feat incredibly. So I just...
You say that, but don't you think that maybe Grace is the wrong one, but Barnes and Grace both don't play for England as much as they should.
No, that's true.
Because they can make more money outside, don't they? Like, I mean, it didn't... Maybe, you're right. Bradman probably would have been the breaking point for cricket in which they would have had to take this more seriously. But they didn't for Barnes. In fact, they went the other way with Barnes, right? They literally said with Barnes, oh, fuck off and play your club cricket. And then occasionally I'd be like, actually, we want to win this test series. Are you still free?
Yeah, I mean, Australia in 1921 lose Ted McDonald, who's one of their... you know, with Jack Gregory, part of their great fast bowling pair, probably actually the first great fast bowling pair in terms of actually being fast that we've seen in Test cricket. He leaves to go and play in Lancashire as well. So there are examples before, but Bradman was such a star. I suspect that might have been a catalyst for people to play their players more. I don't know. It's but given the way cricket's run, it's funny. There was an irony as well with Bradman that he's then kind of lecturing players on his disgust of them going to World Series cricket, and you're like, hang on a moment, you almost signed with Accrington, you kind of did, and then you pulled out because this kind of weird consortium of people came up to offer you more.
So but, I mean, it's really interesting all that sort
sorry,
of
yeah,
stuff.
Just finish. Yeah, because Malcolm Knox, he works out that Australian players in the 1890s actually earn more in real terms than Australian players for basically a century on. So that's completely right in terms of, it shows how underpaid they are for a long, long time afterwards, which is where everything comes from. It's where World Series cricket comes from, really the rebel tours as well. They all kind of come from this central problem.
There's a great line during World Series cricket, and I forget the name of the guy, but he wasn't a particularly high up person in Cricket Australia, but like let's say he was a vice president or a treasurer or something. And he was just like, if they don't want to play, that's fine. There's 3 million other guys who want to play.
Play for the
bat. And it's like, like I get your general point, but if you took the best 15 out of any sport, are you still expecting to win? And isn't that what it is? And it wasn't, right? Like, I think we have I don't think there's a cricket nation on earth, as you said before, forget the vagaries of selection because, okay, yeah. Some of it was tough and the geographical issues. And as you said, if you're the selector from Victoria, you're not going to last as a selector from Victoria if you're not picking Victorians. Like all those things do play a part. Don't get me wrong. But just the fact that there was never what I would call a unified push to be like, can we get the best 11 players on the field at this stage? To the point, to go back to Australia again, because I do think Australia is quite fascinating in this. You have that sort of Bob Simpson, is it Bob Cowper as well? Maybe I'm just mixing them up. But Simpson and Cowper both retire at 28 and 30. Ian Chappell retires 30, 31, I want to say.
Greg Chappell misses some tours, including 81 Ashes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some of that, yeah, no, but Australia has a history of guys retiring between 28 and 31, right? And everyone knows what it is, right? Bumble talked to me about it recently. It's like, you know, that period where everyone was retiring because they made more money working in the city than they would playing cricket. So no one, I was brought up knowing those stories, right? At no stage did anyone go, do you know what? I would think the Australian team might be better if Bob Simpson plays till he's 33 rather than retiring in the middle of his peak. Like it's a really, like if you think about Bob Simpson as a cricketer, He can bat, he's a very good fifth bowler, and he's one of the best slip fielders in the world. Even if he got shit, right, and he I think he was averaging 40-odd, right? If it comes down to like low 40s or high 30s, you've still got someone who can bowl really good leg spin and fielding. And it's like, how many good players do you need to lose at a young age before you start to go to yourself, I don't know if the math is mathing here, guys. Surely we should be doing something. And it just never occurs to cricket all the way through, does it?
No, because the people who run it, they're just bumbling through and they see it as a bit of a, well, I think they're so obsessed with basically status and, you know, advancing the establishment as they see that they kind of like it the way it is, to be honest. It's like the you know, they don't really want things to change. You know, even with Peter May in England is another great example, a fantastic player, retires as age 30, you know, and surely had another five, you know, I think he was probably quite close to your top 50. Well, maybe he was in at a certain point.
He would have been in my top 50, I think, if he played a little bit more. No, he struggled away from home. I love Peter May. So, yeah. No, but you're right.
But yeah, he retires so early. And still, then he goes and earns lots in the city. Yeah, but it's like, this is not the way to grow the game by letting the best players go early. And then, of course, you're both doing that and you're kind of ostracizing the ones who are like, actually, I want to be a professional cricketer, but the way I can do that is playing in Lancashire League and stuff. You're then kind of banning them as well. Yeah. So it's completely self-defeating on different levels.
One of the other things I was fascinated in your book was, I want to get his name right here. In 1951-52, Nigel Howard, who I must admit, I knew the name, but I didn't know much about. Nigel Howard was named captain for a full tour. He had a batting average of 17.2.
His first average was 23, right? And he's pitched as a specialist batsman.
Hey.
He thought Zach Crawley was lucky to get all his test matches.
Zach Crawley sitting there going, what about Nigel Howard, everyone? Why are you slagging me off? How much of that is just because he's an amateur and they've run out of amateurs, I suppose?
It's completely because he's an amateur and he's the right... And because most players have been on the good players have been on the Ashes Tour the previous year and they don't fancy going on another one. And England, of course, have this weird thing. It's very English in this era where unless it's an Ashes Tour... If it's away from home and they lose, it doesn't really count, remember? So they will go to the Sydney's and lose and say, but we haven't picked our best team, so it doesn't really matter. So they have this weird approach as well. So they're kind of losing matches, but they're pretending it doesn't matter. And really, until Len Hutton becomes captain, that's probably the turning point, releasing and taking all tests seriously. But even like until the 50s, England would just pay players more for Ashes tests than non-Ashes tests, right? And so it kind of feeds into English cricket psyche, but there was this such a, yeah. So that they were just picking the right sort of person to be captain. And they probably just thought he was a good bloke and he deserved to be captain of England for a tour.
It's funny. Cause like we make fun of the, you might remember him, the Nigel Bennett who becomes Surrey's captain by accident in after World War II. Like you make fun of that. Cause he wasn't, it's like, he didn't average that much less than Nigel Howard did for England. Right. Like, I'm sure Nigel Howe was a slightly better cricketer than him, but not that much different.
No, and even when Len Hutton becomes captain, he still calls Freddie Brown, who's the kind of previous amateur captain, he still calls him skipper. So he's still, it's like so ingrained. And Hutton is interesting because he's he obviously breaks the divide, but it's obviously he's quite a conservative figure as well. So he's sort of almost probably who the establishment, I guess, if the establishment had to have anyone to break the divide, they would choose a guy such as Len Hutton, basically, because he fits in. You know, he's very kind of, he observes the sort of social niceties. So he's not really, even though he's picked on, you know, he's the first
he
guy.
He wasn't rocking
really
the boat.
Probably
was he? He wasn't.
On merit.
There were other.
He still kind of fits in with the overall view.
Because there were other professionals who could have been captain before then that probably would have been more upsetting to the actual establishment, right? And you know, you can understand that. There's another great stat from your book which I really really like, which is between 1948 and 1966, 8 out of 10 England captains came from Oxford or Cambridge. But that I mean, that's good. From 1930 to 1977, 15 out of 28 came from there, and I'm a little bit disappointed in my wife, who studied at both of those universities and somehow still didn't manage to captain a side. But it really shows you how. I remember having this conversation with someone who was very much from one of those kinds of families that we're talking about here, and we were talking about Shane Warne. He goes, "Well, obviously Shane Warne's a genius," and I went, "Really?" And he goes, "Well, if he went to a really good school, I'm sure he would have got really good marks." And I went, "He went to one of the best schools in Melbourne, and he was still fucking shit at school. Like, he is a genius." But he's not like your idea that he's intellectual and academic is completely wrong. I think if Shane Warne ever proved anything to us, that was not his way. And like, you know, you could argue that with Ben Stokes and I don't know, maybe some other captains who are very venerated. They're brilliant at reading the game. They're not particularly good. You know, you wouldn't want them doing your taxes or anything, right? Like you wouldn't want them representing you in court, like for fuck's sake, right? So there is a different angle, I think, on that. And there's no doubt that England, after sort of relaxing themselves on the class thing, they replaced class with this education thing of, well, if he can read books and he was a, I'm going to say Cambridge Blue. Does that sound right? Or is it Oxford Blue? One of the Blues, anyway. You know, he was a good cricketer there. And it's like, there's a real element of once you become a Cambridge or Oxford cricketer and a good first-class cricketer, you're a real, very good chance of just captaining your country, which is such a bizarre thing to say.
Yeah, and this is the Brian Close thing, really, where people look at his career now and they're like, how did he play so little for England? If he was good enough to play age 18 and age 46, why is he only playing, what did he play, 25 tests or something? So why is he playing?
It wasn't many, was it?
Yeah, and he's a great captain for Yorkshire, and it seems to fit in with that. And so even after Hutton, they can kind of go back and they do pick people who, like Peter, even if they're not officially amateur, they still fit in with, they're kind of as close as you can be to amateurs without being amateurs.
It's a class thing, isn't it?
Smith,
it's don't you think that like there's the class element there? They're just replacing the status, which is moving in English society anyway, right? So instead of picking someone who is naturally from that class, you're now picking someone who is educated like someone of that class.
Well, you're picking people who would have been amateurs a generation earlier, basically. And so you are kind of self-replicating. And interestingly, there is an element of this elsewhere as well. So with Pakistan, they have Abdul Kader, Javed Berkey, Majid Khan and Imran Khan, who all go to Oxford or Cambridge. And with Jared Miandad, who we know likes to pick a fight, but he's not wrong in picking this fight when he says, you know, in Pakistan, there's a real thing where we obsessed with people who went to Oxford or Cambridge. We're also obsessed with actually just being able to speak English. And it's like, why does that matter? You know, why is that relevant? So this does. And I think in terms of who organises tours, right? And when you're thinking of, you know, a tour to West Indies or a tour to England or whatever, I think the people who organise those tours, they are thinking about the cocktail parties. They're thinking about who they want to speak.
I was going to say that.
And this is with Fred Trueman as well. Yeah, this is what they say, because Fred Trueman plays 20 test matches away from home, which is incredible. And seemingly he plays kind of badly in West Indies in 53-4. And then you can think he's not the sort of guy that, you know, you want at the ambassador's party and stuff. So this has a real impact on again, who's just who's picked in the team. Because a cricket tour is not just a cricket tour, right? A cricket tour is a political event, and it's about how you want to represent your country in that. And so every country really is thinking about this, and I think Australia are thinking about it probably like least, which is a factor.
As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year, and I loved every part of it except for one. This little evil pin here, because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, or one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, or one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally.
Yeah, I think Australia probably gets lucky as well, though, don't they? Because Ponsford and Bradman, trying to think of some of the others that follow, and Benno, probably are the
they
right
are, but Australia
of
has a thing
people.
Where every player is basically a semi-professional until the 80s. So you don't have to think so-and-so can't be captain because he's a professional. So I think that just makes it a lot easier. And I think...
No, exactly. But if imagine that Ponsford was not like Ponsford, or Bradman was not like Bradman, right? Like, there might be an element of where you have to fix it. And maybe they didn't have to fix it as much as they would have in other places. But you're right. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that Australia is the outlier in almost any way you look at international cricket. Like, most of the other places, you have a sort of a school system or a class system, or as you say, in some places, an English system of like, if you speak English correctly or whatever that may be. And Australia just doesn't really fit in. Like, Warwick Armstrong is like, you know, a completely different kind of character to what the sort of captains that you would probably normally be looking at from other countries. People come from all varied kinds of backgrounds in Australia. You know, there are other problems within Australian cricket. There's a Catholic Protestant issue at one stage. And, you know, as we said before, there's a little bit of the lack of professionalism, but it is different. And then you go to like even a country like Sri Lanka, which doesn't play test cricket until the 80s, and yet is still dominated by like two schools, right? Like, you still have that sort of old English thinking there. And, you know, I mean, remember when Eton versus Harrow was going to be cancelled and the Lords members got really upset? What's the biggest cricket game in Sri Lanka every year, right? It's between, was it Trini and Royals?
Yeah, 10,000 people. I don't even know. And it swamps yeah. around a test match in the same city at the same time.
So it's the same thing over and over again. And a lot of that is just, it's the colonial hangover, right? Like, it has to be. Like, there's no other way of looking at a lot of it.
Yeah, I think the only thing we haven't with the captaincy that's worth mentioning is the batting v bowling thing. So there's such, and this is linked to class, but it's basically you have a situation where your captain has to be a batsman. And by having that is where you're going to get. So actually having Benno, Richard Benno as captain is actually quite significant. Again, would Benno, I don't know, maybe he would have been appointed at the same time. Railing was appointed not that long after, I suppose, for England. But it does, that's part of this equation as well. So if you're saying it has to be a batter in the top six, really, then that you and we're only picking our batsmen from a certain group, then of course, no wonder who your captain's going to be from a certain background, because you haven't really given anyone else a chance.
And that's also, it's self-fulfilling, but it's also not by accident, right? Like, the reason that they said that batters had to be captain is because there's no real reason. And in fact, I think Australia have a bowling captain. Is it George Giffen from South Australia? Might be a bowling captain in the late 1800s. I can't remember when he played. So there had been, like, it wasn't like no one had ever picked a bowling captain before, but there was this general feeling that you couldn't do it. But when you go back and you have a look at who the batters were, especially if you go back all the way to late 1700s, early 1800s, before overarm bowling comes in, at that stage, the best batters are quite often older guys with big, heavy bats and the ball's rolling along the ground. And so they're, you know, it's like a 55-year-old who's probably also the Treasury Secretary of Lords, right? And so, of course, they're going to say that batters
happen. But even in the 1890s, so Jim Phillips, who's sort of like the first sort of super umpire of his day, so he umpires a lot of Ashes tests, and he says there's this huge difference in how the England captain talks to his team and the Australian captain talks to his team. He basically says the England captain is a kind of an autocrat. He doesn't listen. He doesn't listen to people. Yeah. And the Australian captain is actually happy to consult everybody. And also, he's happy to consult bowlers, because if the English captain was consulting anyone, he was consulting his friends who were the batters from the same sort of background, everything. So again, Australia a little bit able to actually kind of access the whole cricket knowledge of their whole team, rather than just say only we guys know your job is just to bowl and don't think about it kind of thing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Give me three more bits of the book that just sell the book here with your classic Wigmore engine.
So talk to tons of great players. I could work for a great 11, but yeah, including talking to Sachin. And one of the great thing, you know, fascinating things talking to Sachin is, in his first 44 tests away from home, India only win a single one. So one out of 44. So yeah, it's incredible actually to reflect how bad India were for so long. So that was a great one to do.
And what did he say? Did he say, stop asking me negative questions? What's wrong with
you? No, he did sort of talk about the kind of weird thing where he would do everything right. Because obviously this is the 90s when he's actually probably Sachin's peak, actually, yeah. You know, and yeah. And so there's story in Barbados in 1997 when India need 120 to win. They're 2 for none overnight. Tendulkar goes to a restaurant on the cliffs in Barbados, and he goes to the waiter, champagne, and he says, yeah, can you chill that? The best bottle of champagne, can you chill that? I'll be back here tomorrow to drink it. Tendulkar gets out cheaply the next day. India bowled out for 81. Have a very traumatic defeat. And he says, locked in his room for 2 days afterwards. Which is, yeah, a sad story, though he had plenty of good stuff in his career as well. But that was, I guess it shows how brutal Test cricket is. And also, I guess the extent to which you're not just fighting the team, you're also fighting history. And it becomes hard to win a West Indies because every other team has gone before you hasn't done either.
Okay, what else you got?
Oh, wow, I've got so much. I will talk about, so why West Indies get good, I think, is, you know, we talk about the great players in that era, but also they're picking from their whole talent pool. They have these proper professional players, so they are, they have tons of overseas players in club cricket, in league cricket. You have World Series cricket, and you have impact of team fitness, team psychologists, and so on. So yeah, the kind of professionals of that West Indies team and the kind of deconstructing, I mean, the talent there was incredible, but the whole point was they were actually able to make the very best of their talent in a way they probably hadn't been before. Yeah. So that was really interesting to look at as well, with a sort of with fresh eyes. And I suppose, yeah, to go back to so many little things, but as you'd expect, but yeah, so he's looking at Victor Trumper. One of the great sort of stats that you kind of think about what he'd have been like to see. And the great stat, which I think does convey that what it'd be like as a fan, is he scores faster per hour than any player in history. And he still has that record because, of course, overrates are so much faster then. But it's like, if you're going to a game, you're not thinking, he's 40 or 54 balls. You're going, oh, he's got 40 and it's in 40 minutes. That's really, really quick. And so in terms of what it'd be like as a spectator, that, I think that does give a bit of a sense of the kind of the magic of him. What was he, number 40 in your list?
42, is he? He's around there. Yeah, he's around 40. You're right. I mean, he's remarkable, isn't he? It's like, I love the fact that no one catches up to him really till Viv Richards. Like, he's such an outlier. It's like, we can't do it. No one else can work it out. And yeah, it wasn't just him. I don't know if you looked at the stats, but Clem Hill, who was batting with him, was also really underrated. Quick. And you're just like, and no one even writes about Clem Hill being quick. It wasn't
three runs less.
It's ridiculous. And he's just completely ignored. Probably the first great left-hander as well. So no, I definitely think that's a great one. That's actually, that period of cricket, it's a shame there weren't more teams playing, but it is a fascinating period.
Talk about this. It's a kind of, I call it the golden era or cricket's missed opportunity. And of course the golden age or cricket's missed opportunity. And of course it's both, because it is an incredible era. Ranji and Trumper and everyone who are bringing the game forward, Sydney Barnes and so, but you also have the great, missed opportunity, because that's when the ICC is formed, 1909. And the key word there is imperial. And that excludes Argentina and USA, which would have made for some very fun away tours, and you have a whole different game. And that's, I guess, that was a frustration writing the book. There were chances again and again there were kind of doors that weren't open to really expand the game. We could have, almost every nation that's got test status could have got it a few years earlier, and this happens again and again.
Just throwing it out there, we didn't need to pull the test status. Yeah. But that's maybe that's more for me and Rod to have another episode on that in the future. Wigmore, your book is called
History Yeah, 5 years in the making, talked to over 40 of the best players of all time. And I think bibliography is 18 pages long. So this took a long time, lots of research.
It's a big book.
It's a narrative history full of stories and characters. If you like cricket, if you listen to this podcast, therefore you like cricket and therefore you'll enjoy the book.
It's about 1.5 centimeters smaller than Bob Wilmer's book, just so you're aware. But I think he's got
Simon Wild weighed my book. He said it was 850 grams, but he said Steve Waugh's was 1.8 kilos. So it's half of Steve Waugh's book.
Don't get me started on the fact that when Australian captains used to retire, they used to think they were like Churchill or like Roosevelt, and they would release these ridiculous books. And you just the Ponting one, I think I still have it somewhere. Peter Lawler writes the start of it, right? And it's, I don't know, maybe 80 pages. And you're like, this is really good. I didn't know a lot about, young Ricky Ponting, and it moves quite engagingly and everything. And then it just feels like it is player diaries from then until and it's just like they might as well have just stuck all the player diaries together at the end, right? I could be wrong in this, but I'm pretty sure there is a bit in the 10,000 page opus of Ricky Ponting where it's like, today went to the gym, didn't feel like much more. I might have made that up with
the ultimate playbooks are so small. Like Leary Constantine's book is like 120 pages, Jack Hobbs as well. And it's like, they're not messing around, but the modern ones, some of them are.
Yep. I think, Fred Spofforth's is about 20 pages or something. Yeah. Like it was just like, it's barely a book. Like it's incredible. My favorite cricket book moment of all time is Stuart Broad's Ashes 2009 book, which he's run out of things to say about this series. And so in the middle of it, he talks about every single player. And of course he has quite strong opinions on a lot of the players. Then he gets to Graham Manu, right? And he's got about a paragraph and a half. And then he goes, he only played one test. Don't know much about him. And it's just blank. That's it. It's just Graham Manu's name, two paragraphs and blank. Think he's a good wicketkeeper. Don't know much about him. But your book is certainly more detailed than that. I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever said this about you. I think you might be a better writer than Stuart Broad. I'm just putting it out there. I don't want to be controversial. I know he's got a book out as well.
He's always got a book out last year.
He's had a lot of books out. All right. Wigmore, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And I'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.